something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. And in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Roy Baumeister on the podcast. Dr. Baumeister is currently professor of psychology at the University of Queensland and is among the most prolific and most frequently cited psychologists in the world, with over 650 publications. His 40 books include the New York Times bestseller Willpower. His research covers self and identity, self-regulation, interpersonal rejection and the need to belong, sexuality and gender, aggression, self-esteem, meaning, consciousness, free will, and self-presentation. In 2013, he received the William James Award for Lifetime Achievement in Psychological Science, the Association for Psychological Sciences' highest honor. And his latest book, co-authored with John Tierney, is called The Power of Bad, How the Negativity Effect Rules Us and How We Can Rule It. Roy, always great to chat with you on the Psychology Podcast. You're a veteran of the show.
Well, glad to be back, Scott. Always fun to talk with you.
Indeed. It is quite an honor to talk to one of the most legendary social psychologists on this planet about current issues. You know, I thought we could kind of keep this conversation relevant to the state of the world that we're living in right now and all of this scare. And let's not beat around the bush. We're seeing a lot of bad in the media these days.
That's for sure. And it's always true. Now they at least have some legitimate things to complain about. You know, most of the time it's kind of surprising that, you know, life objectively gets better and better and the media keep telling us about, you know, we're about to fall off a cliff.
So, yeah, with this coronavirus scare, a lot of people are falling off a cliff, so to speak. So there is some reason to have fears. Yes?
Yes. Well, we're not saying there's nothing bad in the world, and there certainly is right now. What the point of our book was is that the human mind has a natural tendency to overreact to bad things and to overstate how bad they are. So it's quite possible and probably true, I would say, that both things are going on. Yes, the coronavirus is bad. And yes, it probably sounds worse than it is. So some of the negative reaction is justified and appropriate, and some of it is probably exaggerated. We don't know for sure, but that would fit the general pattern.
Yeah. Well, let's go back a second to the 2001 classic paper, Bad is Stronger Than Good, just to read some of the abstract. Bad emotions, bad parents, and bad feedback have more impact than good ones, and bad information is processed more thoroughly than good. Hardly any exceptions indicating greater power of good can be found. That's incredible. You really, it was hard for you to find any exceptions.
It was to us too. And you know, when I started noticing the pattern, and this is sort of the way I work, is I read a lot of stuff and look for things that reminded me of things. And I started seeing this pattern that bad was stronger. And I said, well, let's do a review and let's find where it reverses, because that'll make the theory much more interesting. And it will also explain why bad is stronger, because we could see, well, if bad is stronger in these things and not in those, then something about these explain the power of bad rather than those. But the problem was we just couldn't find the exceptions. And one place after another, like, we had a bunch of pet theories ourselves. There were four of us on the paper. We each had our own theory about, you know, like, well, maybe bad is worse in the past, but the future good would be, you know, you'll be more drawn by the future good than the future bad. But no, a future bad thing affects you more than a future good thing. So all our little pet theories were dashed. In a way that makes it more exciting, because it's such a universal pattern. We somehow stumbled on one of the basic properties of the human mind. But as I said, it made the theory less, you know, less interesting and complex. You know, you'd like to have a fancy idea with lots of well-designed exceptions and so on.
Sure. Wow. Well, that is pretty dramatic. Now, how has that research held up since then? This is now 2020.
Yes, well, when we got started writing the book, I said, well, we'll read all the papers that have cited it. At the time, it was just a couple thousand. It's now almost 7,000 papers have cited it. But pretty much they just say, here it is again. Now, there are a few people who tried to find exceptions, and I'm always, you know, interested in those. But you know, they're pretty feeble, and they don't hold up that well. It just seems to extend into one thing after another. So. It's rare for a paper to be cited that much without some people finding contrary exceptions. There's some interesting recent work sort of trying to address why it might be true beyond the idea that it just makes evolutionary sense to watch out for the bad things first. You know, Uncle Bach and his group have shown in many things, you know, hitting the middle is good. So there's one way to be good. To be, you just have the right amount. And two ways to be bad. You can have too much or not enough. So the too much or not enough, those would be qualitatively different, and that might explain, you know, somehow the greater power of bad or something like that. So that's an interesting extension of it. Again, nobody's come along to say there are contrary findings or other patterns.
That's super interesting. Yeah, the negative, you know, it seems like if it's not enough, it seems like that's more relative than too much. There's some things I feel like are kind of objectively bad, regardless of our position to others, you know, like an impending sort of death, like a cancer diagnosis or something. But the not enough, you know, people could be like, oh, I don't have enough money, and that's really bad. But that's usually like relative to others. Is there any truth to what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess having too much money is not usually a problem that people complain about.
Right, so, that's right.
Not all things that I like that. And, you know, some of my own research in personality traits, self-control, there doesn't seem to be a problem with having too much, or intelligence having too much. So a lot of things, more is just better. But you know, looking outside, look at the temperature. You know, the temperature can be just right, which is sort of in Fahrenheit, somewhere between 50 and 90. And then there's too cold, which is one kind of problem, and too hot, which is another kind of problem. And those problems manifest themselves in different ways, and you have to deal with them differently. Obviously, you put on more clothes when it's too cold and take them off when it's too hot. So yeah, there are many things when being at the appropriate level is the best, and too much or not enough are both bad, but in different ways.
Cool.
But, you know, in terms of your broader question of how is it held up, it's held up surprisingly well.
Yeah.
It's the second most cited paper on my feed, even though it's related to nothing else other than this book coming out. And you know, most people, their most cited papers are the culmination of years of research and of many papers.
You got away easy with that one, Roy.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, it was just kind of stumbled on it. Yeah.
Well, your other one has held up. I assume your most cited is the Need for Belonging paper. Is that right? I'm guessing.
Yes.
And that one's held up pretty well too. No one. It's not like the replication crisis came out and they're like, well, the people's need for belonging didn't replicate. turns out people don't really give a beep about that, you know.
Hi everyone. Just wanted to take a quick break and talk about my new book that's coming out April 7th. It's called Transcend: The New Science of Self-Actualization. Really excited to present this book to you all. It represents the culmination of many, many years of hard work and synthesis. What I've done in this book is I've taken Maslow's classic hierarchy of needs and I've revised it for the 21st century, trying to bring back humanistic psychology. I think that the field of humanistic psychology in the 50s and 60s really got a lot right about humanity and the creative possibilities of humans, as well as the humanitarian and spiritual possibilities. Really hoping this book can present a vision of humanity that transcends us all and helps us connect deeper with each other, but also help us reach our greatest potential individually and collectively. So if you want to check out this book, you can actually pre-order it right now on Amazon, as well as there's independent bookstores I think you can pre-order it from. And then on April 7th, starting April 7th, it should be in bookstores. A lot of people have been wondering throughout the years how they can support me and the Psychology Podcast. And here's the time. You know, you're always welcome to contribute money to the podcast to help support it. If you're a long-time listener or even short-time listener, you want to not only support the podcast, but dive deeper into a lot of the concepts and ideas we talk about constantly on this show. This is a great way to do that by buying this book. So please check the book out and let me know what you think.
So you're doing pretty well in this replication crisis, except for perhaps someone could say the self-control. What is the theory called with the
ego depletion? Well, that's been replicated.
Ego depletion.
Except sometimes it doesn't replicate. So that's something where there are probably some boundary conditions, but I don't see how any honest scientist could read the literature and say there's no effect there. There's clearly an effect with 600 significant findings and none in the opposite direction.
What are some of the criticisms?
On the self-control thing?
On ego depletion.
That's been a very successful theory, and so it invites attacks. There's one line of argument saying that it's not a limited resource, that there are other sorts of things, change in motivation, subjective beliefs. I think all of those have something to contribute, but in terms of replacing the theory, they don't. But, they're still questioning the theory. That's fair game, and there are some things we don't understand and how the mind-body part of it. In our lab, giving people a dose of glucose, which is the body's energy supply, that wipes out all the manipulations, as it should, if being depleted of your willpower means that your body doesn't have enough energy to spare some for further acts of self-control. But other people question that and don't find that. So some are arguing about what is the causal mechanism, the process. And then there's some saying that there's no such effect because they don't replicate it in their lab. Obviously, the two criticisms contradict each other. So one of them at least has to be completely false.
Right.
Can't have a valid alternative explanation if there's no phenomenon. From my take on it, the idea that there's no such thing is absurd, given the weight of the evidence. The one exception would be if you decide you're not going to believe anything social psychologists have done. But I think people are hoping for that. There's some people trying to make their careers by tearing everything down. That's in a way fair. I mean, if it were to be established that there's no such thing as ego depletion, I would have trouble believing anything in social psychology. We found it over and over again for 20 years in many different contexts, and people replicated the finding again all over the world in different laboratories. Many people I never met or heard of have found the same effect. So if all of that can be mistaken, then yeah, there's something so fundamentally wrong with the way we do research that I would say abandon social psychology entirely, but I don't believe that. But to argue about what is the process and mechanism and what are the border conditions, I mean, that remains a lively and open thing. And over the 20 years, I've revised the theory multiple times as new data come in. That's, I think, what you should do. I never assume I get it right the first time. So my approach is to do it. I follow all the criticisms, and sometimes I read what people say and say, oh, they've got a very good point, and they're changing my thinking because of that. You know, initially, we thought it was that the brain was running out of fuel, and somehow it was using up fuel. That was a plausible first thought about it. But I've been convinced, to the extent it's tied to, say, the glucose, which is your body's energy, modern people aren't running out of that. So it's allocation. It's, you know, does the brain decide I'm going to keep putting energy into this endeavor or not? That's a different kind of decision that, oh, I don't have enough energy. Now, maybe that we evolved under conditions when conserving all your energy was really important. Your immune system, for example, again, coming back to, I guess the immune system doesn't really help against the coronavirus because we don't have any immunity to it. But your immune system responds to infections by fighting them and trying to get you healthy again. And that uses a lot of glucose, but it just uses it once in a while. I learned this from Suzanne Segerstrom. And so, you know, back in the olden days, before there were antibiotics or any sort of medicine and so on, if you got an infected cut on your foot, it could possibly kill you. You needed to conserve all the energy you could for, you know, for crises like that. Not to mention, it might be hard to find something to eat tomorrow. You might have a bad day and the hunt doesn't work and you sometimes go hungry. So we evolved under conditions where it was a lot more necessary to conserve energy. Hence, self-control is a more modern development, at least modern in evolution. That's an expensive use on it. And maybe when the brain thinks I've expended a lot of energy, maybe I need to cut back now and conserve energy, feed the other organs, preserve it for the immune system, and so on. So I'm just bringing this up as an illustration of revising that theory, and I expect that to continue. I don't think we've got it perfect yet, but there's clearly something there. And you mentioned the replication thing in social psychology in general. With a couple of colleagues, we're trying to go through all these, because, you know, the ego depletion got publicity because they did it first. But now it's become familiar. They're failing to replicate one thing after another. Was prompted to do this review. I was at a conference a couple months ago, and they said they had just done a big one on terror management theory, and that had not worked either. And I thought, well, I don't even really like terror management theory, but I've replicated their findings, you know, a dozen or two times. There's clearly something there. So there's something wrong with the way we're doing these multi-lab replication things. You know, for one, if you fail to manipulate the independent variable, it's not a test of the hypothesis. If you want to say anxiety causes risk avoidance, when you're testing that theory, if you fail to manipulate anxiety, then even if you don't get an effect on risk avoidance, that doesn't mean anything's wrong with the theory, right? Because you haven't supplied a test group. There's no way your data can say anything about whether anxiety causes risk avoidance if you fail to create the difference between a high group and a low anxiety group. You can't learn anything about what effect anxiety has on risk taking. So, and that the first study on ego depletion that didn't work, they didn't manipulate it. And I've looked into a number of all these other things. The Boston Schooler manipulating beliefs in free will to see if people who are led to disbelieve in free will would cheat and steal more, which they showed, and they had a manipulation that worked, but they had a very motivated population, and then other people try different populations who aren't as motivated, and they don't get it, they don't care, and they don't respond to it. It was one one of the failures in the many labs replication thing that reported that they didn't get that fit. But I tried to look up, did they manipulate the independent variable? It was very hard to find because that was not prominent. You had to look in all the obscure online supplementary materials and finally look there. And then, no, they failed to manipulate the belief in free will. Well, then, again, you're not drawing any conclusion about the effect of belief on free will on whether people will cheat and steal because you haven't manipulated the independent variable. So that's one possibility for why these things aren't working. And I suspect that's true with the terror management and lots of the others. I mean, there are dozens now, and mostly the record is pretty dismal. Now, why that is, I don't know. I know people like to imagine you can just bring someone to the laboratory, or actually they want to run these on computers, so you can just put the instructions there and people will read them and follow them. But, you know, people doing these online studies aren't nearly as involved in them, and sometimes they're watching television or eating or drinking or whatever. So their responses are not as motivated. One of my mentors, Joel Cooper, was here on sabbatical. Mm. He's now in his 70s, and his life's work was on cognitive dissonance, which, again, something that's replicated hundreds of times, although lots of people don't get it. He says, yeah, I'm just waiting till they come after me with one of these big online things. He says that it'll never work on an online thing. He says, you know, it's so important in dissonance. You've got to get the person there and make eye contact and engage them and get them to care about what's going on in the study. And then they care about what's happening, and then their responses reflect that. And he said, you know, the way they do these studies, that will never work either. And, you know, that's one of the foundational theories in social psychology. And he's calling it before it even happens. I gather they're trying it now. We'll see how it turns out. But that might be a factor too, you know, that getting people involved and getting them to care. My regret about the way they're doing these replications are, one, okay, it's interesting to say, well, they got it and I don't get it. But instead of saying, well, then we have to figure out why it happens here and why it doesn't happen here. That's the right scientific approach.
Yeah.
But instead they say, oh, no, your findings are all wrong, you know, and ones that don't get it say, you guys must be faking your data or doing something tricky or analyzing the data in tricky ways or whatever. And then meanwhile, the ones who get it are saying about the others, well, you're just doing it wrong, you're not getting people properly involved. And so both yelling at each other, you know, we should try to do studies that, you know, replicate it in one condition and not another. That will teach us what the conditions are.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's really the true spirit. If we're all good faith actors in this game, then that's the right spirit to have.
Part of the problem, that's what some of the impetus was, the Diedrich Stoppel and a couple others who were found to be faking data. And that sort of raised the specter of how widespread is this. My assumption is most social scientists are honest and decent people and really doing their best to find out the truth. And then some of them are sort of politically motivated, trying to advance the social justice causes that they want, or a little more suspicion of them scientifically. But nobody's out there just the way Stoppel is, was, you know, deliberately faking data so as to advance their careers. Well, I won't say nobody. There are clearly a few doing that, but I think that's a strong minority. And in particular, when I find something that multiple labs has found, then I start to think, well, that has to be something really there. If there's only one person that gets it and nobody else does, yeah, then I'm suspicious. And as you know, I'm a literature reviewer, and I'm doing more of that as I get older. Think about the big issues and read lots of different literatures. So it's kind of how I operate. If it's found in multiple places by unrelated labs, there's got to be something there. And if other people don't get it, well, there has to be something explaining the difference. I mean, I believe in causality in science.
There's almost like a social status boost you get to show, look, I didn't replicate something that a very well-known finding. You know, there's sort of this tendency to feel a sense of glee almost that, look, there's a thrill to not replicating something that has replicated, you know, and is in this I'm taking down the intro psych textbooks, you know? And so do you know what I'm saying? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know that. Yeah, I mean, when I was in graduate school, if we couldn't replicate something, we assumed it was our fault. You know, I must be doing it wrong. But now, the new thing is, no, if I don't replicate it, it's somebody else's fault.
Right, yeah.
But neither of those is entirely healthy. If some people get it and I don't, well, there must be something we're doing differently. And the assumption that somebody is faking or p-hacking or any of that stuff, I think that should not be the primary assumption.
Yeah. Well, I really do like the spirit upon which we try to figure out, you know, we're all in this together, right? Let's try to figure out why are we getting this and you're not getting this, and maybe even join forces. So I like
that. Because what you said, the journals seem to favor failures to replicate.
It's so
an economics paper a couple of years ago that before the whole replication industry really got established, if you repeat somebody's experiment and you find the same thing, the journal editors don't want to publish that. They say, well, what do we care about this? We already know this. This is not news. But if you repeat somebody's experiment and don't get it, then the journal editor says, oh, well, that's interesting. So you're actually better off failing to replicate in terms of being able to publish your work in a prominent place. And that's a dangerous incentive. I think they're taking steps to correct for that now. With some of these replications, you register them in advance and they'll publish them however they turn out. So that's healthy.
Roy, in an ironic sort of or meta sort of way, how does what we're talking about right now relate to the larger topic of this conversation today, which is that the bad is stronger than the good? Does this apply at all to scientific research? You see what I did there?
The initial finding is good, but it's more of an exciting scandal if other people fail to replicate it. So the bad thing gets publicity, and then you know, the way the media have a bias toward negative things, so they'll publicize the bad news, and then after a while other people find it, but that doesn't get as much publicity. So when you mentioned that original replication study on ego depletion by Hager, and so got lots of media coverage, say, oh, look, it didn't work, something's wrong with the theory. And then this guy Dang, when he published the data a couple of years later, the original data, he went and analyzed it, and he said, well, the manipulation check didn't work. And to the extent the manipulation check worked, it was significant. Mm. So that they did replicate it, but that didn't get reported. And then he also published, I think he ran a multi-site replication around the world, and that was significant. And he said, yeah, it worked there too, but again, none of that gets nearly as much attention. So the media like that. And that's true, unfortunately, for people and their reputations as well. It's been well known for a long time that some bad news comes out, it will destroy your reputation, and then exonerating information comes out later. And the media might report that too, but it's, you know, hidden away and doesn't get nearly the reaction. So it's really hard for someone, especially falsely accused people, it's really hard for them to rebuild their reputation or recover their status because the bad gets so much more publicity than the good.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously potential negative implications of that for early career researchers who might be scared of taking any sort of risk whatsoever in their research or the topics that they investigate out of fear of reputation damage, as opposed to the explorer spirit.
I think that's possibly. I'm hearing that a lot. I've really cut back, you know, I'm getting older and training graduate students, which is a big part of my career up until now. I'm kind of phasing out doing that. But from the ones I hear who are actively doing that, from my younger colleagues who are still training, they say they're more and more scared of publishing something that might turn out to be wrong. And that it takes away much of the discovery. I mean, it assumes before you do an experiment, you know exactly how it's going to turn out. So you can't learn from your data. You know, my generation, I talked to my colleagues, well, we would run a study with an idea, and then it would turn out differently than we thought. And then we'd think about that and try to figure out, and then we'd run another study to react to that. And then, you know, after three or four or five of them, you start to zero in on what's really going on. But if you had to be right in the first place and didn't reanalyze your data or try something different or, you know, really learn from your mistakes, the whole discovery process would be short-circuited. And also, being scared takes the fun out of it. A lot of people I know are saying social psychology is just not fun to do anymore. Whereas it really was for a long time, partly because of this discovery. Like I said, I never assume I know what's right when I get started. And so for me, it's a process of trying this and listening to the data and analyzing and really trying to figure out what's there and then doing more and building on that. So a lot of my best work has come about that way. But the young people won't get to do that if they're scared of being wrong. I was maybe scared of being boring. I never wanted to be boring.
Yeah. Well, that's. I think you could say you successfully never became boring.
So, well, thanks. You know, our mutual friend Marty Seligman says that there are two kinds of scientists. Yeah. Never be wrong or never be boring. Right. And I try not to be wrong, but I hate to be boring. I'm willing to take a few chances.
Well, Marty was successful in that regard as well. Both you and him were successful. Yeah. And I hope I can be successful in saying that too someday.
Pretty well so far.
Well, thank you. We don't need to view these as mutually exclusive categories, right? Like, you can be interesting and do interesting topics and do good science as well. You know, maybe we can give a message to early career researchers to take some risks but just do it well. you know what I mean? Do the risks, do the science well, but take the risks. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, you know, the idea that there's one sort of methods that should be used all the time, and that you have to pre-register everything and know it. Well, we got to leave a little more room for exploring. We're going to really shut down a lot of the creativity in the field. And we should adjust the methodological standards to the topic so we can study everything. You know, my take is you've got to use the best available method and not the only method. I remember, like, way back in the 70s when they did that first study comparing, you know, studying people who were in the hospital who had been seriously injured. And, well, that was in the Social Psych Journal, which at the time mainly had laboratory on studies on undergraduates, and there was a very different method, and, you know, wasn't quite as strong. I lacked some of the methodological strengths of a laboratory experiment with undergrads, but it was such important information about how people coped with serious long-term injuries and disability. You got to relax the standards, study everything with the best method available at the time. And that's how the field advances, to say, no, you can't do anything unless you have 100 people per condition. Well, that's just ruling out large swaths of things that we ought to be studying.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think we're on the same page with that. So, you know, returning to the overall theme, because I didn't necessarily expect us to go on that whole topic, you know, down that whole route, but I'm glad we did. I think it'll be beneficial to people listening. But talking, you know, recentering here for a second, why are we wired for bad? I mean, do you fundamentally think that from a brain wiring perspective, where we evolved a kind of a brain, a neuromachinery to make us focus more on the bad than the good?
Yes, that is very much what I think. And we came around to this early in the process with a line that's in the Power of Bad book and so on, that life has to win every day, death only has to win once. Avoiding something that's going to kill you has to get priority. You know, people do take risks. They do things that are, you know, promote survival and reproduction at some, or they can trade those off. I'm thinking of people who have sex with somebody they're not supposed to, and somebody else might come around to kill them, which happened in most societies in the history of the world, going back even to prehistory. But for the most part, yeah, to to survive and to advance. I think that has to get priority. I mean, learning what to eat and how to eat food, how to prepare different kinds of complex foods. And that took trial and error. And, you know, a mistake could kill you. So naturally, you want to be cautious on there. You know, a mushroom might look good, but the chance that it's poisonous and will bring instant death should discourage experimentation along those lines.
Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense evolutionarily. But even, you know, as you well know, a lot of things that evolved to be adaptive aren't necessarily productive or constructive in this day and age. You know, we can kind of overshoot the target in a lot of ways. How is the Pollyanna principle a potential natural weapon we can use against the bad?
So the Pollyanna principle is just to look for the good side and put positive spin on things and make the best of it. Yes, I think that's a useful attitude to cultivate somewhat, not to be blind to bad things, but to notice the positive and attend to it. There really is a lot more good. I mean, our book is called The Power of Bad, and it says bad things have stronger effect than good things. But nevertheless, it's a positive, upbeat book. You know, life is basically good and has gotten better in almost every respect over the centuries. So we fail to appreciate how much better off we are. You know, I do a fair amount of reading of history and other cultures and stuff like that. And sometimes sort of remark to myself, anyone born in the United States or Western Europe after World War II should never complain about anything compared to you know, what most people have had to endure and suffer through. And to consider that the poor people in the United States, the bottom 10%, they live in so many ways better than the kings and queens of medieval Europe. They have much better entertainment. They have more and safer sex partners. They have better food. I mean, the kings of France and Spain, you know, back in the 1300s or whatever, couldn't get fresh fruit all that often. Couldn't ride in a car, certainly couldn't fly in a plane. They didn't have cable television, had people to play music for them, but again, not nearly the amount and diversity of music that's available. If you had a toothache, you just had it. You know, you were just going to have to wait it out and a couple months of pain. I think there's a line by Ben Franklin. So that was just a couple centuries ago saying, oh, if humanity could only solve the toothache, everybody would live in bliss forever after. And that's a useful perspective, because you must, you know, if you've had a toothache, and hardly any of us have had a lasting toothache, but remember the worst pain you had at the dentist, and imagine just having that around the clock for a month.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way a lot of people lived, and we've solved that problem. You know, people just don't know what that's even like hardly anymore. And yet we don't appreciate how great that is.
No, we don't.
I think the positive thing about the Pollyanna is, you know, recognize the bad things. I'm sure they have to be dealt with, but also attend to the good and refocus on them and appreciate how much positive stuff there is in life.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think that for some listeners that might feel like cold comfort, though, if they're get hit with this virus, you know, if you're, you know, individually, you know, kind of putting this in context and thinking about this in the history of humanity. I mean, there is one way we can kind of take a more bird's eye view of this and say, it's better to have the virus now than the 1918 flu pandemic. You know, we're in a lot better shape now. If I had to choose between getting the 1918 flu or this virus, right, in 2020, it's good to be in 2020. So, you know, what sort of positive spin can we at all?
It's better both the time and the virus is not as bad. I think the death toll is not nearly. I mean, that epidemic killed more people than World War I.
Yeah. I'm just trying to see, for our listeners, you know, completely freaking out over this situation, what words of wisdom can you give them based on your lifetime of research?
Well, if you get it, the thing is, most people who get it won't even know it. Most people have no symptoms, and then most people who have symptoms, it's not all that bad. They say it's like having the flu. It's unfortunate, and it will kill a few people, which is tragic. But for most of us, the impact's not nearly as bad as it would have been at another time, where we have communication, coordinating responses, at least at the country level, and somewhat at the international level. So I think they're handling it reasonably well. And, there's no way to prevent things like this altogether. But still a lot of good stuff in life. If you get the virus, okay, maybe you'll be sick for a week. But then life will go back to normal, and life is pretty good. So, yeah, it's not to make light of negative things, but to just put them in context and appreciate the others. And I think, getting back to our book, the more important thing is not just your attitude, but putting this actively to work in your own life. So, yes, there are bad things, but you can do good things and pursue good things to outdo it. And so we want to keep in mind the rule of four. It's not just that one good thing is needed to overcome one bad thing, but rather four things at about the same level of magnitude will compensate for it and possibly put you into the positive. So in relationships, you do something bad, annoys your partner or whatever. Well, that's going to happen. Don't just think, I should do something nice for him or her to make up for it. I've got to do four nice things to get the relationship back on a positive track. If you keep that in mind, that's the formula. That's why life is good, is that a lot of little good things outweigh the few big, strong, bad things.
Yeah, you say, plan on at least four compliments to make up for one bit of criticism. If you want to keep your business afloat, aim for at least four satisfied customers for every unsatisfied one. That's a very proactive message that offers hope for it, and kind of a corrective to, how do I want to frame this? In a way, it's kind of a strategy for resiliency in life as well, because you could see how the human mind could be designed to panic at one bad thing and say, there's no way we'll ever get out of this. But instead, it kind of shifts it to a more productive, constructive approach where you say, okay, well, now we just have to work really hard to kind of get four more good things going on here to kind of outweigh it. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely right. Again, there's no way to prevent all bad things from happening. All lives have bad things in them, and we have to recognize those and live with those. It's just cultivate a lot of good things. I worried 2001 when we published this, positive psychology was just taking off, and I had a lot of sympathy with the movement and friends there, and I worried, will they not like me because I'm saying bad is stronger than good? But what I tried to highlight for them is it's all the more need for positive psychology because we need to teach people how to cultivate more good things, because life is good and good wins by force of numbers. So we need to generate a lot of good to overcome the occasional bad.
I love that. Here's a question for you, Roy. Why are hell-fearing religions historically more popular than ones preaching a benevolent message?
Yes, I'm not as an expert on that. And we cover that in the book. My co-author, my friend John Tierney, he had more expertise in those, but it seems to be there's a perennial appetite in what people want religion for is to recognize the negative side and recognize the power of evil in the world and to gloss it over and make religion a kind of self-esteem boosting self-help thing. They drift that way. That's sort of comfortable and seems to fit modern life, but it doesn't really resonate with people's spiritual needs. To be sure, I think one impetus to religiosity is to cope with bad things. I've noticed myself, and I think there are general data showing the same thing, that people turn to religion when life gets hard. Indeed, when I was doing the research for my book on how people find meaning in life, I read a lot of, there's a chapter on religion, I read a lot of history and sociology of religion. And I kind of came away with the impression that the decline in religion in the modern world is largely because life is too good. And that if really awful things happen, you'd see people
clinging to religion,
turning back to it. Religion, and I've known people personally who, after a tremendous personal setback or whatever, would start attending church again and becoming more religious. It's part of the value and power of religion to give people a conceptual and emotional framework for dealing with bad things. So religions that acknowledge both hell and heaven seem at least to inspire a lot more passionate participation by their members than the sort of watered down Protestantism that doesn't really believe in hell, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Gordon Allport used to write a lot about the psychology of religion, and he did have this distinction between like more deprivation focused religion, which you have the religion to avoid to avoid punishment. It seems more deprivation based versus growth based religion, which is moving toward goodness, moving toward love. And I always thought that was a really interesting distinction. He talked about different flavors of religion, and I always really resonated with his work, and it seems relevant to this conversation.
I don't remember that from Allport. The deficit and growth thing we associate with Maslow and his
I'm putting it within Maslow's terminology.
He would have been a contemporary of Gordon. Floyd Allport was older.
Yeah, they had some interesting exchanges. I actually have seen some private correspondences between Maslow and Allport, which was cool. So Gordon Allport called it mature religion versus, like less mature religion, but I'm putting it within Maslow's framework. So that was very keen of you to pick up on that. That was very keen of you. Allport really, talked about, what would a mature religion look like? It seems like what he was talking about was more of this kind of growth oriented form of religion, where it's more open-minded and open to the inconsistencies of the religion, and as opposed to immature religion, he talked about as being more self-serving and representing negative stereotypes that people have about religion in general. So I don't know. I just made that link on the spot. It's not like I had prepared my notes that I was going to bring up Gordon Allport, but it seems relevant to this conversation.
But using the ideas from that time, self-actualization was central in Maslow's thinking.
Yeah.
And so religions, some of them do promote a form of that, the meditation and so on. It's not so much trying to cope with negative things in the world as to transform the mind and the self in a positive manner. But again, what often people brings people in the door in the first place into church is negative aspects of life. Yeah. The great soteriologies, the religion, Buddhism and Christianity and Judaism and so on, they tend to have their common view that life is suffering. They were ways for people to deal with the negative aspect of life. Is basically a downer philosophy, trying to say that, life is suffering, but you can get off the cycle of rebirth by meditating, or you can get reincarnated in heaven and live happily forever after, if you do these things. So there are ways of coping, but they're starting with life is suffering as the premise, and that's just not something we believe anymore. And yeah. With good reason. We don't have two things. We don't have.
Imagine starting a religion whose premise was life is good. You don't need God. You don't need anyone but yourself because you got all the goodness within you. That'd be an interesting religion.
Lots of people have that approach. They don't call it a religion, but that is sort of one widespread view right now that elevates the self to supreme value and goes with a non-religious approach. I think it's risky. I'm finishing up my next book on the self and sort of revisiting the idea of making the self one of the basic values to pursue to guide your life. That's consistent with individualism and much of the way we think about people in the modern world, but it's risky because obviously the self dies when you die. So your life's meaning ends when it ends. People have generally drawn positive meaning in their life from things that will outlive them, that will last longer, you know, like religion, which has an eternal time frame, or political movements that are going to create a better society in the future. At the individual level, people often do it, you know, for their children and grandchildren and draw meaning from that. The more you replace that sort of future-oriented time frame with studying and glorifying the self and learning about the self and building the self, well, that doesn't have any lasting value after you're dead, although some of them imagine that it does.
Well, that's a very interesting view of the situation. I guess I'm thinking of, you know, how can we live our life where we don't appeal to a God necessarily to keep us on track, but we do have faith that stemming from our own potentialities, we can transcend ourselves, you know, by doing good, by having purpose. So I guess it is by getting out, we can get outside ourselves, but we don't necessarily have to connect with a higher supernatural being in order to get outside of ourselves.
Right. A lot of things come down with being nice to others and helping society and so on. Those seem to be fairly universal values. If you subject that approach to a rigorous philosophical questioning, I'm not sure it really holds up all that well. Because what's the purpose of your life? Well, it's to help other lives. Okay, well, what's the purpose of their lives? Well, that's to help other people yet. It's sort of like passing the buck. You're passing the existential buck, and everybody's life draws value from everybody else's life. And, well, is that just some kind of Ponzi scheme?
Wow. Wait, so what do you think? That might be a bit of a cynical way to view human altruism, but what do you think is the best route to the good life then? Have you figured that out?
Oh, well, I don't know that I'm quite all there yet. That would have to be the next book after this one. I'm just kidding. But you know, it's clear, not clear, but it looks like pursuing happiness in the sense of immediate good feelings only works for a while, and that wears off some. That it's clear that when we do live to benefit others, that tends to be pretty satisfying. Not perhaps in an existential sense that it creates more meaning, but that's sort of biologically the way we evolved, to care not just about our individual selves, but about the group. And so we get satisfaction for it. We go back to the 80s, social psychologists debated, which philosophers had also debated, I think, in the 70s, you know, is altruism really possible, or are people just making themselves feel good? You know, you feel bad and then you do a good deed and then you feel better. Well, is that just a sign that you're really being selfish after all, or are you really doing a good deed and then having to get a reward for it? But, you know, my take on it is we should just be pleased that the human psyche evolved that way, that we get pleasure and satisfaction out of doing things for others. So that, you know, these questions that go on unresolved forever, it's usually that the question is wrongly phrased.
Oh, that's really interesting. You know, there's hope here, right? You offer ways that we can see the bigger picture, that we can really move towards a more realistic and balanced view of life. You talk about the negative golden rule. What is that, Roy?
But the golden rule, of course, is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But given the power of bad, and bad things are stronger than good, the more important rule is don't do to others things that you don't want them to do to you. So it's just emphasizing the negative version of it, but that's much more important. You think, oh yeah, I would like if people did this or that for me. Okay, well, yeah, it's nice for you to do that to other people too. But first and foremost, focus on reducing the harm, doing the negative. So don't do things to others that you would really not want to have done to you.
And that's a good way to live one's life, yeah?
Yes. Yes, good way to construct relationships and deal with social environment and everything else. I mean, it's just a variation on the classic golden rule advice, but it recognizes the greater power of bad.
Good. I like that. Okay, keep giving me things to live the low bad diet, as you call it. How do I get on that diet? I want to get starting right now. I want to get on that diet.
All right. Well, I think we had 5 suggestions for the low bad diet. First of all, you don't have to be perfect. Perfectionists tend to be dissatisfied and unhappy, often neurotic. Indeed, for this book I was writing, I've been going through a lot of things about mental illness, and you'd be surprised at how many psychological disorders have perfectionism. Well, you might not be surprised, but many people would be. How many psychological disorders have an element of perfectionism in there? Forget about being perfect. Just concentrate on being good enough. Eliminate the negative. That will get you far. And then, you know, we can slowly seek improvement, but the important thing is to get to where you're good enough. Second, bad things are going to happen, but focus on the big picture. Calamitizing the bad, or overstating it, or again, this is the end of the world.
Yeah.
The classic thing is the teenager who breaks up with his or her girlfriend or boyfriend and says, oh, I'm never going to, no one will ever love me again. I'll never be happy again. I might as well kill myself. Well, come on. There are plenty of other things to live for, and there are certainly plenty of other people. My research on broken hearts showed that people feel real bad when their heart is broken, and then they find somebody else, and then they're happy again.
Mm-hmm.
It works reliably well. So there's a lot of good in the world. As I said, don't get carried away with the bad. Another bit of advice was to use this with the media too, is recognize the media, and it's their business model. I'm not attributing nefarious motives to them, but the media tend to exaggerate negative things and focus on negative things. That's what sells newspapers or gets clicks or whatever. Tierney, my co-author, was a journalist, and he said very early in his career, he started wondering, why does everything have to be a crisis? One of his first assignments was writing something about local weather pattern. And, under the influence of the editor, he was starting to build it into this crisis. And, wait a minute, it's just some weather. It's not a crisis. But you recognize that the media are doing this and then compensate. So, actively look for some positive media stories. You can sign up to a cartoon service to be emailed a cartoon every day. Or whatever it is, when you're reading something negative, deliberately look for positive stuff in the media. Fourth, make some time for nostalgia. Think back on the good things in your life. I mean, a lot of us tend to automatically remember things we did wrong or things we regret or whatever, but that sort of gives you a negative view of the past. Indeed, we have a paper about to be published on people's spontaneous thoughts, and thoughts about the past are the most negative. Not all of them. But on average, the present is pretty pleasant. The future is mixed. There's a lot of good in the future, but negative thoughts about the past, often involuntary ones, ruminating and sort of remembering bad things, but just make an effort to remember positive, happy things. And my buddy Constantine Sedekidis has this great line of research on nostalgia. He said when he started doing it, nostalgia was assumed to be a sign of mental illness or neurosis or something like that. You tell his colleagues, oh, I'm remembering the happy time I had there. And they say, well, what's wrong? Are you feeling depressed? Are you upset? No, I'm actually feeling good. It's a reason, or one of the reasons old people are in general happier than young people is they do bring back things from the past and enjoy those positive memories. And last, remind yourself that, yeah, overall, things are getting better. You know, right at the moment, we've got this virus spreading around the world, and so, yes, some things are getting worse. There's an economic downturn going to be a consequence of this, other problems. But mostly, life is much better than it was 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 500 years ago. The long-term trend is very much upward, and like we were saying earlier, people adjust so rapidly, and they forget about things. And, you know, you used to just suffer from toothaches, and now we don't do those. We don't have toothaches anymore. But instead of appreciating how great we have it, or living in bliss forever after, like Ben Franklin suggested, you know, we just forget about it and worry about other possible things in the future. So, yeah, again, look at the big picture and the overall positive trends in individual lives as well as society and collectively, that just constantly new and better things happening.
This is great stuff, Roy, and I hope it helps our listeners get through this tough time. And a lot of what's tough about it is the uncertainty of the matter, not necessarily the reality of the matter. So maybe putting things a little bit more in context and focusing or bringing more, you know, four good things in the day for every one news story they hear might actually help them.
Good. I hope so too.
Thanks, Roy. It's always such a great time chatting with you.
Okay, Scott. Likewise. Thank you. I hope it's a good podcast.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes and subscribe to the Psychology Podcast YouTube channel, as we're really trying to increase our viewership on YouTube. In fact, many of these episodes are in video format on YouTube, so you'll definitely want to check out that channel. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.